You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
And in particular, cookies are portable. You would do a great deal for waistlines at the Brookings Institution if you would take away as many of those as you possibly can. The second thing I want to do is very pleasurable. It's an opportunity for me to introduce two people who we either all do know or should know, and whose contributions to this field I'm sure you will appreciate even more after you have heard from them. The first is an old friend and colleague in many contexts, John Chauvin, who is a professor of economics at Stanford University, and who directs, now for the second time, the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research, and does so with more skill and grace and effectiveness, I have to say, than any director of a research institution that I know of who is now actively in that job. He agreed to come out and talk to us about some of his ideas that he has developed alone and in collaboration, including with Sita Slalov, who is here today, but also in a book with former Secretary of Almost Everything, George Shultz, on the challenge of an aging America. After John speaks for about 15 minutes, Steve Pearlstein of the Washington Post is going to respond and make comments on what John has said and on anything else that is on his mind. Steve has been a source of journalistic pleasure to people in the Washington area and wherever else his articles may be reprinted for many, many years. He has also, in recent years, become a professor of economics at George Mason University, where he teaches a course that is organized in a rather innovative way and that has always struck me as a clever and pedagogically effective way, which is to start with some important puzzle or fact from the real world and then use that as a motivation to introduce concepts in economics. Well, that's enough of the introduction. Let me remind you again, please carry away cookies. And in the meantime, John Chauvin. Yeah. Not too soon, in fact.
I obviously ate too many cookies. I want to thank the organizers and the Sloan Foundation for supporting this work. Let me start by questioning the fact that people are working to older ages or that age-specific labor force participation rates have indeed gone up. To return to an old theme of mine, that depends on how you measure age. The remaining life expectancy of the average retiree has not gone down. Mortality of the average retiree has not gone up. Retirement lengths have been getting longer, not shorter, even in the last 20 years. So in a very real sense, people are not working to older ages. Now, I recognize that by conventional years since birth measures, they are. But I think that the readers of your paper should be reminded, and some of you have mentioned this already, that while the retirees today are further from birth, they're also further from death. So it probably is time to think about and continue to think about maybe we're measuring age wrong. Certainly in other fields, like in data, the speed of data transfer, we've come up with new measures like gigabytes per second. So maybe we should think about, continue to think about how to measure age. Now, I believe that the issue of adjusting institutions for longer lifetimes is actually one of the biggest issues of the next half century, right up there with dealing with climate change, dealing with entitlement reform. It's related to entitlement reform and the other big issues. I think it hasn't been you know, given enough attention. That's why I like this kind of work that's going on here. Let me give just a couple of facts about demographics, life expectancies, and interest rates. I believe that most people underestimate how long their retirement resources are going to need to last. I think Gene had roughly the right numbers. The most recent study I have seen, and actually even today, we saw that the average retiree today, the male is 64 years old when they retire. The women are about 62 on average when they retire. So let's say that those two average retirees were married to each other. You have a 64-year-old man and a 62-year-old woman married to each other. How long is their retirement likely to last? And instead of asking what's the life expectancy of the woman and what's the life expectancy of the man, say we ask probably the more meaningful question is how long until both of them have passed away, the second to die, the length of time until the second to die. And if we use the mortality tables of the Social Security Administration, the cohort mortality tables of the Social Security Administration, the answer is more than 27 years, 27.38 years, or 27 and a half years if you want to round. Well, that's a pretty long retirement. The second death for a couple, 64 and 62, is expected in 27 and a half years. If they're just a little bit lucky, if their combined lives is not at the 50th percentile, but at the 75th percentile, 31 and a half years. That's a long retirement. Certainly, if that couple wanted to go to an insurance company and buy a second-to-die annuity, they know that there's some adverse selection. They're going to price that out with 30 years of payments, at least, in mind. Now, what were the corresponding numbers in 1961 when, for the first time, men had some choice as to when to collect Social Security? Well, the average age of retirement in 61 was not 64 for men. It was 66. And we saw that in some figures today. So say you preserve the two-year age gap and you ask, well, how long in 1961 would a 66-year-old man married to a 64-year-old woman, how long until they're both passing away in terms of expectation, the average length of their combined lives? 21 years instead of 27 and a half. I'm claiming that today's retirees have a 30% longer remaining lifetime. That's a big change, 30% longer remaining lifetime than they had 50 years ago. Now, say the couple wanted to provide for their retirement, and let's abstract from Social Security for a minute. Just ask, how much wealth would you have if you're doing it on your own to provide for your retirement? Well, if you got this 27-and-a-half-year goal, and let's say you thought you needed 75% as much as you had in your earnings career, and then you'd want to know the present value of that real stream, well, present values have become pretty easy in a world of zero interest rates. what it costs you to finance 27 years of retirement is 27 times what it costs you to finance 1 year of retirement. So the answer would have just been 75% of 27 and a half years, or a little over 21 times your earnings is the wealth that it would take to finance that. What would it have taken in 1961? Well, you wouldn't have a zero interest rate in 1961. You might even have the 2.9% real rate that Social Security often uses to discount. And instead of 21 years, 21 times multiple of your earnings, it would have been 11.7. In other words, today, the present value of financing your retirement, it's up more than 75% compared to 1961. And about half of that increase is due to living longer, and half is that the interest rates have disappeared. If you think a zero interest rate is sort of a disappeared interest rate. So let's go back to this today, though. A 64 and 62-year-old couple who appear to, on average, have about 27 and a half years left in them. How long could they possibly have worked? They're 64 or 62. 45 years seems like the highest number you could possibly come up with for the working career of a 64 and 62-year-old couple. And so just ask yourself, with American-style savings rates, can you finance a 27-and-a-half-year retirement with a 45-year career? Anyway, I mean, with Social Security, with defined benefits, with defined contributions, with all stock portfolio, anything you want. My answer is, that's tough. It basically can't be done, or it seems like it's very, very hard. And my prediction is just from the sort of pension mathematics, how can you save enough as a society or as an individual to finance retirement? It's going to force retirement ages to continue to go up. And what I think is that today's Stanford students, the students I teach, they're going to have to work till 70 as the average. That's my guess. I think this, the force of this longer lifetime is just going to force them to work longer. Whether this is a bad thing or a good thing, I don't have any value about this. I don't think it's so terrible. In fact, I'm not sure they're going to have to retire that much shorter than today's folks. Most estimates would say that today's young people, 20-year-olds, will live an extra 4 years or so, 4 or 5 years, compared to today's retirees, and they may have to devote most of that to work, maybe all of it to work. Henry mentioned that with co-authors, including Sita Slavov, but earlier George Schultz, I've thought about some policies that might encourage longer work lives, or another way to say it is stop discouraging long work lives. Social Security, for instance, you know, in the early part of your career, you're actually earning benefits for working, and more work gets you more benefits. But as you know, Social Security only counts 35 years of work. So many people in their, say, 60s, if they've had a full career without an interruption, they're paying Social Security taxes, but they're not getting any benefit, any marginal benefit. So we came up with this idea of paid up. And actually, let me just describe it slightly differently than Henry did. What we came up with was after 40 years of work, covered work, there would be no payroll tax for you. Not for Social Security, not for Medicare, not for the employee or the employer. You're paid up. And so it's really a 15.6%, I think, is that the right number, tax that would be removed. Obviously that would either give you a 15.6% higher salary or maybe lower cost or split between the two, but that would make a big difference. That's what we proposed. Secondly, we did propose, as Henry said, switching from Medicare as a secondary payer to Medicare as a primary payer. By the way, Medicare was a primary payer until about 1983. This was a Reagan change. And we're just saying it should be undone so that under Medicare as a primary payer, if you're 65 and you've got Medicare, you go and you want to work, you go to your employer and say, hey, I've already got my major medical. So obviously you're a more attractive employee or you're going to get more and so forth. I would say that the best article we have seen on labor supply elasticities by age was by a guy named Eric French at the Chicago Federal Reserve, and that's what we use, and he finds that there's quite a bit of elasticity, labor supply elasticity, among people in their 60s. And he looks at both, he looks at lifetime labor supply elasticities as well as the elasticity at older ages. Now, the last thing I want to mention, I'm getting close to done, is, you know, Sita and I have been working on claiming strategies for Social Security, and actually it's broader than that. It's really general, how to Well, what we call it is efficient retirement design. How do you design your retirement efficiently? How do you combine your private assets and your Social Security to maximize retirement resources? And we find that almost everybody who files for Social Security as soon as they can, either at 62, maybe they retired before 62, so they file right at 62 or within a month or two, or whenever they retire. That is, we see almost nobody delaying the commencement of Social Security beyond retirement. And so what they do then with their private assets, almost by necessity, if you've done that, if you've collected Social Security as soon as you can, what could you do with your private assets except try to supplement your Social Security benefits with your 401k assets or your other private assets? There's really nothing left to be done other than to use your assets as a supplement. Now, we find, and the most important thing we find, really, is that this almost universal practice is almost universally a big mistake. Private assets should not be used, first and foremost, to supplement Social Security, but they rather should be used to defer Social Security. The return to deferring Social Security is not determined by market forces. It's determined by legislation, and it's actually determined by legislation a long time ago. And those returns for deferring Social Security are outstanding. They're fabulous. They're way above market, however you want to say it. Today, for some people in some circumstances, not uncommon circumstances, the return for deferring Social Security is 5 or 6% real rates of return of 5 or 6%, in a world where real safe rates of return are zero or negative. So it's an outstanding return, outstanding in the sense it's way above alternative returns. If you wait till for collecting Social Security, I'm not talking about retiring now, I'm just talking wait to collect your Social Security, and you wait till 70 instead of collecting at 62, the monthly benefit is up by 76%. And while you're waiting, you do get those inflation adjustments as well. So it's 76% real higher at 70. That's quite a bit gain. Now, the gain for deferring depends on your circumstance. It depends, are you single? Are you married? If you're married, are you the high earner? Or are you the low earner in the marriage? It depends on all those things, but we find that some deferral, some waiting, is optimal for everybody. Or just about everybody. Obviously, if you're on chemotherapy, you've been diagnosed with cancer, you don't want to defer. But we find it's a very, very small set of circumstances that which would cause you not to want to defer. We found that people whose mortality rates are twice the average, so say you're a 67-year-old woman and your mortality is twice the average, like you're a smoker, you still should do some deferral. So it's that good a deal that even having twice the average mortality is not enough to completely stop deferral. We find a single male, by the way, it's a better deal for marrieds in general than singles, and it's a better deal for single females than single males. So the least favorable one is single males. We find a single male smoker, and by smoker, I just mean two times the mortality of most average single males, should defer collecting Social Security until 65. Should not collect at 62, should wait 3 years. If that smoker happened to be a woman, should wait till 68. It's pretty impressive when you think about it. So obviously some people, mortality risk is worse than two times, but not many. We find that the gain to optimally claiming your Social Security for couples can be $200,000. Those people are leaving $200,000 on the table. This is not a small tip that they just forgot, or, you know, it's not like they left a $5 bill and they wish they hadn't. A couple hundred thousand bucks. This is bigger than the average 401k account. So the immediate claiming instead of optimal claiming hurts the resources of widows in particular and widowers. And so, anyway, we think it's a big deal, and we're writing stuff, including we've written two articles on this topic, but they're kind of professional articles, which aren't going to have a lot of impact, like most professional articles don't have a lot of impact, but we're trying to write a booklet. And we have a unique plan of distributing this booklet. The unique plan is free and electronic. So we'll see how that works. But we're going to try to get organizations to give us a link so people can see this our stuff. We're not alone on this. Actually, we're not claiming that our ideas are original. Maybe the whole package is original, has some originality. But interestingly, everybody who looks at this carefully comes more or less to the same conclusion, and whether they're academic. Just in the last week or two, I ran into a, I guess you call it a booklet, produced by Prudential, the life insurance company. They had it pretty much right. And so we're going to try to gather the forces that are coming up with these ideas and see if we can't get a push to get people to stop leaving a couple $100,000 on the table and help have more resources in retirement, and particularly help widows. Because if you defer your benefit, you all know that it's the high earner. It should be obvious to you, but let me just tell you. If you're in a couple, it's the high earner who really should defer. It's more important that the high earner defer than the low earner, because those high earner benefits are going to become the survivor benefits, and the low earner benefits are not going to become the survivor benefits. And that's just the way the rules work. And so it's actually good if both defer, but there is a priority. And the one that really needs to defer is the one whose benefits last for two lifetimes, or the maximum, you know, second-to-die annuity, instead of the other one, which lasts as a first-to-die annuity. That's all I've got. I hope you'll be looking for our stuff, because we're going to try to make an impact.
Good. Well, good afternoon. Thank you, John. A little disclaimer. I'm not an economist. Actually, I don't, Henry, teach in the economics department at George Mason. As you can imagine, they wouldn't have me. I'm in the government department. And I'm not an actuary, and a lot of those tables and that data that we listened to this morning makes my head hurt. So just you'll take this as all of this as the reaction of a journalist. First of all, I'm very happy to know, my birthday was 2 weeks ago. I turned 61, but I'm very happy to know that 61 is the new 54. So
there
I'm,
you go.
So I'm already feeling better, except that I also know that my wife should retire and I have to keep working until I'm 70. So
just defer claiming.
Thanks a lot. I would make a small point. Which is the point of a non-academic. John's paper, for the sake of analysis, assumes, or his comments and his papers that he has written, assumes that because the tip rate is zero, that the discount rate is zero for money. In terms of the way people, real people in the real world, think about their retirement savings and perceive it, they don't think that their rate of return is zero. You can invest in a broad portfolio of dividend-paying blue-chip stocks and earn 2 to 3%. You can also put your money into the Wellesley Income Fund at Vanguard and over a long period of time be pretty sure that you're going to earn in excess of 5%. So I don't really think that's the way real people think about their discount rate. I'd sort of like to step back a little bit and because a lot of this has to do with John's work, has to do with, or his paper, about how much incentive or disincentive we are giving people to continue to work or not continue to work. And I just sort of like to start out with a very basic and obvious thing, which is some years ago, in the 30s and then in the 1960s, we decided as a matter of social policy, because we felt it was fair, because we wanted some economic security, that we adopted this program called Social Security, and we adopted this program called Medicare. And these are inherently disincentives to working.
So we shouldn't be surprised that there are disincentives for older people to work. We set it up that way, not because we wanted to maximize GDP, but because we felt better about it. We liked it. That's what we wanted to do. So now, in order to do that, we set up what was then a small intergenerational transfer, which has now become a huge intergenerational transfer because we set these up as pay-as-you-go systems. Now, it is pointed out by John and others that because of the tax and benefit system that has grown up around these two programs, we've created marginal tax rates that are now a further disincentive for old people to work that require, according to John, even more, another round of intergenerational transfers in order for us to solve the problem. That is, let's let people who work beyond 65 do so without a payroll tax, or a payroll tax holiday, or let's let them dip into Medicare earlier, even while they're working, essentially raising the cost to that program. It seems to me we're on a slippery slope here, piling on sort of one more intergenerational transfer to solve a problem created by a previous set of intergenerational transfers. And if you sort of worry about those sort of things, I think we probably want to call a stop to it. It's also, I think, some of his work raises a philosophical question. Is the lack of an incentive a disincentive? And is every time there is a lack of incentive, a disincentive, do we have to have government step in and try to solve that problem? For example, when he talk about a paid-up program, well, that sounds nice, but is the program really paid up? Well, not really. None of us, as far as I know, ever really fully pay for our Social Security benefits or for our Medicare benefits. So we're not really paid up, and I think that's a misnomer. And I sort of feel uncomfortable about us paying up less. In his paper, John has a lot of discussions about the incentive effects of implicit marginal tax rates on old people, older workers, and how this will change their behavior. It seems to me implicit in all this discussion about that and how that affects people is that we are foresightful, we are rational, we are well-informed, income-maximizing economic actors. In other words, we act like economic models say we're supposed to act. And so these high implicit marginal tax rates are bad because they discourage us from working, and then we shouldn't do that. But John also described to you some very important work that he's done about Social Security and when it is the best time under the current rules for us to retire. And he's basically shown that most of us make this huge mistake when we make our decisions about when to retire for Social Security, and that we're all leaving a lot of money on the table, up to $200,000 a year, which over a 30-year retirement is... for a lifetime, rather, which over 30-year retirement is $6,500 a year, roughly. And we're leaving that on the table. Well, it seems hard to me to reconcile, just sort of a step back philosophic way, whether you believe that we respond very aggressively to implicit marginal tax rates and that we're also silly about this other thing. Either we're all silly or we're all rational, but we can't be both at the same time. I think Henry's already pointed out an obvious problem, which I don't consider huge, but John's solutions, which are Medicare first and the payroll tax holiday, will weaken the solvency of those two programs. Now, as Gary and Gene pointed out this morning, yes, but people working longer and generating income longer will generate more money for the Treasury and the income tax, but that is a separate pocket of money, unless we want to figure out a way to transfer that money back into the systems, then we have a political problem, and everyone in this room is obviously aware of the political problems associated with that. I'd like to deal a little bit with something Gene said today, which is that we don't have to worry about the demand problem for all this additional labor from older workers, that because of the decline in birth rates during a certain period of time, there will be demand here, and that basically, well, there will be demand. I'm not sure that we can count on that effect. I think we can certainly count on it to a degree, but it doesn't seem to me axiomatic that supply will, in this case, create its own demand as it did when women came into the workforce or when immigrants came or when there was a technology change and suddenly there were excess workers because of productivity increases. I think that in a global economy where wages and prices are sticky and institutional arrangements favor insiders over outsiders, I don't think it's necessarily true that labor supply everywhere and always creates its own demand. And I think we have micro examples and anecdotal information that all of us in our own ways have seen this. We have seen long-time youth unemployment and underemployment as a persistent problem in major industrial countries over long periods of time. The system doesn't necessarily clear. I don't exactly know why, and each country is a little bit different. But I don't necessarily think it's true that just because old people continue to work, that they won't be taking jobs potentially from unemployed young people, at least not in the short and the medium term. And at the micro level, I think we all work in places where we know that if we were to retire, those of us who are old, and a lot of us in this room are old, that in fact they would hire somebody younger and cheaper, actually. And they don't, or they're not allowed to force us out. So at the micro level, we have some, you know, some evidence or some anecdotal evidence that there is some sort of, there would be some sort of displacement. And we know, those of us who have 20-year-olds who are in the inevitable unending unpaid internship phase of their career, that the system is not exactly working for the 20-something, even those with good education. I would also add that whoever this morning cited S&P as saying that we're coming to full employment in either 2017 or 2018, that I would be very happy to take the other side of that that bet. They always say that after some number of years, their models say that the system will clear. They just always say that. They have to. They're programmed to say that. But there's really no reason to believe that that is true. And, in fact, we know that there are structural problems in our labor markets that probably are the reason we have high unemployment today and why we will continue to have high unemployment in 2017. It seems to me the best argument here is the simplest one, which you have made, which is you can't have 45 years of work pay for 30 years of retirement in a slow-growing economy where retirement savings are less than 20% of your income. That's just math. I don't even think that's economics, and that is a problem. I'm skipping ahead here. For myself, I guess I would tend not to focus on the macro stuff so much as the micro stuff. My father-in-law just celebrated his 90th birthday. He's a federal judge on senior status. And every three times a week, he gets up at 6 o'clock in the morning to go ice dancing. Still. And one of the things I've observed about him, his name is Bob Sweet, is that the reason he lives longer is because he worked longer. that there is a relationship to living longer and working longer that is a good thing. And that's one reason, by the way, to encourage people to work longer, is because they will live longer. So there's a sort of self-reinforcing effect here that probably will continue. But I think the best way to try to encourage that is through micro things rather than macro things. I think the reason people decide to retire or not to retire is not primarily driven by policy. There's all sorts of things, how much money they have, how happy their job is, whether their spouse works, whether their kids live in California as opposed to where they live, or all sorts of other reasons why they've, you know, whether they have a house and a cottage at the lake that they already own that they can go and live in or not. There's all sorts of reasons why people decide when to retire. And I'm not sure that I think it's the most important thing for us to worry about this or try to use policy to affect it. I also think that what drives it a lot are the sort of labor policies or the employment policies of the place where they happen to work. Some places are more flexible about these sort of things and make transitional arrangements, and others do not. And that probably is an area that we ought to think about more than thinking about some of the things we were talking about this morning. The last conclusion I would have after having sit through this morning is that to a surprising degree, markets are working. It seems like if Gene is right, we can expect at least a secular increase in demand for work from older workers. We know that the supply is increasing. We know that the wages of older workers are increasing and that the retirement age is now starting to rise again. So it looks to me as if the market is working pretty well. I'm not sure why we have to do anything to solve the problem. There's not necessarily a policy solution to every problem. And perhaps the best policy ought to be neutrality, which is we shouldn't be encouraging people to retire at any particular age. We shouldn't be discouraging them to retiring at any age. But we should simply keep as neutral a policy as we can while, as Dick points out, maintaining an adequate safety net for the poor and the disabled.
Perhaps unsurprisingly, John Chauvin has a couple of things he would like to say in response,
yeah.
And I would like to give him at least one or two, an opportunity to make one or two more things, to say one or more two more things in response. I want to push a little harder on the two suggestions that John made for policy changes, the fully paid-up Social Security and Medicare primary payer. The first question relates to the observation that at least with respect to the Social Security proposal, this would heavily favor men relative to women, given the fact that women tend to have relatively short working careers. The second point is that these proposals are, in a fundamental way, incomplete. They cost resources, certainly within the individual trust funds of the programs. They deepen an already existing deficit that exists in the Medicare Hospital Insurance Trust Fund and in the social, the Old Age Survivors and Disability Insurance Trust Fund. Whether they deepen an overall budget problem is a closer question in light of the possible impact it would have on potential GDP and revenue collections. But at least in the near term, they're very likely to deepen that problem as well. So to make the proposal complete, you have to combine it with how you pay for it within the trust fund and within the overall budget. And you need to make the case that the use of scarce resources and budgetary resources, God knows, are scarce. Nobody can doubt that these days. You have to make the case that this is a really high priority use of budget resources to provide an additional benefit or a tax relief heavily slanted toward men rather than women, and that is going to have to be paired with some other things that aren't so much fun to do. So I begin skeptical on these two proposals, more for that reason than for the reasons that we may have discussed a little earlier. John, the floor is yours.
Okay, I'll try to. I mean, I'm not sure I can give definitive answers to these things, but let me just say a few things going back to the presentation. Let me start off with the discount rate and say that if you are eligible for Social Security, so you're 62 or over, you've worked for more than 10 years, you're eligible for Social Security, or maybe you even started to collect Social Security, what do you have? Now, I think we all agree you have an asset. You have an asset basically promised by the U.S. Treasury to pay you monthly checks for the rest of your life. It's inflation indexed. So you have a Treasury inflation indexed asset. You could call it a Treasury inflation index security. Your security happens to be a life annuity and not a bond, but it's a pretty darn close relative to a Treasury inflation protected security, a TIP. But to me, it seems almost natural. What discount rate would you use? Well, you'd use the rate of return paid on assets like what you have, TIPS. Now, could you use a discount rate that is higher, like you could get on a stock mutual fund? Well, sure you could, but you're using a riskier rate of return to discount a safe asset. And anytime you do that, you're gonna get surprising findings. I'm claiming that what we're using, namely a zero interest rate, a zero real interest rate, to be clear, which on your safe assets, I claim most of you are not getting zero, you're getting less on real safe assets today. So I do not think this is given the market reality, zero real is a good rate of return. No money market fund is offering that. Every money market fund I know is paying negative real interest rates. No bank is offering on savings deposits. What would it have to be? You have to be paying 2%. Well, that's not in the market. So anyway, I claim that you don't want to use a risky discount rate to discount a safe asset. On the two policies, the paid-up idea and the Medicare as a primary payer idea, one of the key aspects is when we're thinking about how the government would fare is, do we look at the various pockets or do we look at all the pockets combined and see how the government as a whole loses? Now, I don't think we're claiming necessarily that people are very calculating and figure out their implicit tax rates and everything else. All we're claiming is that people respond to their paychecks, to wages, net wages. And I don't think that, by the way, that 45-year-olds are very responsive to wages. You can lower wages, raise wages, 45-year-olds are going to work anyway. When you're in your 60s, work is a little more optional, and the Eric French data is there's quite an elasticity that you're dealing with. If they get paid more, they work more. And in fact, we did a back-of-the-envelope calculation indicating that Medicare as a primary payer would not cost the U.S. government anything. That is, the extra income tax would exceed the losses to Medicare. Now, we can't settle whether that's how the government should think. That is, should they look at all their sources of revenue and worry about their budget, or should they worry about each trust fund and make sure that, you know, no harm's done to any trust fund? So just be clear, Medicare would obviously be paying more benefits.
Medicare situation would be worse. The IRS would be collecting more income tax. Could you develop a system that, you know, to bail everything out? Let me talk a little bit about, it sounded like Henry's concern, one of his concerns certainly was that if you're going to have this paid-up category be applicable to people with 40-year careers, that men are more likely to have a 40-year covered earnings record than women due to career interruptions. Now, I think that's true, although many people, when they retire, are either married, you have a couple, in which case, you know, the distinction between the man and the woman is a little bit blurred. For instance, many widows in this country are not collecting on their own record. They're collecting on their deceased husband's record. So exactly, the gender roles get a little blurred in that case. Even single people who retire often can claim on their ex-spouse's record whether that ex-spouse is deceased or ex-spouse is because of divorce. One strategy in efficient retirement design is to claim your spousal benefits from your ex-spouse or claim your survivor benefit from your ex-spouse, all the while deferring your own record. And at age 70, if it's more, you switch to your own record. But for those first years, you're actually collecting on somebody else's record. Now, certainly there are lifetime single women, but those lifetime single women are probably not having the career interruptions that you were thinking of. That is, usually we think the career interruptions are child rearing and so forth. So I don't know. I mean, this needs further investigation. All I'm saying is that for many, many people, they've got a claim. They've got two claims to work with. You often, one's a man's record, one's a woman's record, and so it might not be as much of a concern as it appears. But that's just off the top of my head. The thing I've got to, you know, that we have to sort out is this issue of, do we worry about the trust funds per se, or do we worry about the government's budget, or maybe we worry about both? And I'm claiming these policies would not, at first glance, they do not worsen the government's budget problem. They may worsen the trust funds, and you have to figure out whether that's something that can be fixed or not.
Okay, we're going to open it up if there are any comments or questions. I just want to put in a plug for one piece of research that would bear on a point that Steve Perlstein made. He said none of us had paid up for Social Security. That's probably not correct. Dean Lemer at the Social Security Administration did a study some years ago, and everything Steve said is right in spades. For all age cohorts born up to about the year in which I was born, I'm right at the crossover point, and people born after me, by and large, have paid for their Social Security benefits, cohort by cohort. Of course, there are high earners and low earners, there are couples and single people, but if you average across everybody in an age cohort, people born after in 1936 or later have basically paid up for their benefits, and by increasingly more the younger they are. People born before that point were the beneficiaries of benefits whose present value, cohort by cohort, was considerably greater than the taxes that they paid. So you're ahead of the game, Steve. I'm right on the cusp.
Let me just say one thing, and Steve mentioned this as well. You know, there's so many studies, including stuff I've done about, you know, arguing about discount rates, and sometimes they're arguing about the discount rates that state and local governments use to discount their pensions. And then there are people that worry that, you know, boy, the DB world had better incentives than the DC world or whatever. There's so many people working on the details, or for that matter, Social Security reform. I think the big picture is this picture of how do you finance 30-year retirements with 40-year careers? By the way, my 45 was an exaggeration. There aren't a lot of people who have 40. The average retiree does not have a 45-year career. So I think I'm not exaggerating, saying we're trying to finance 30-year retirements with 40-year careers. And that's a bigger problem than these discount rates and the DB versus DC and stocks versus bonds, anything.
Right.
That's an overriding problem that has to be addressed.
Comments or questions? Yes, sir.
Eli Greenblum. I'm an actuary, and just one comment on the discount rates. We're not going to discuss that, but the Society of Actuaries slogan is risk is opportunity. I agree. I'm a pension actuary, so Professor Chauvin, you're talking my language, and I agree with basically everything you said. So I'm just glad to hear it. And your big point, which is 40 years to pay for 30 years, is absolutely true. One of the things the American Academy of Actuaries is doing is trying to provide some push for the legislators to do some signaling, because ERISA really will not let you brand a retirement age greater than 65 as your normal retirement age. We would like Congress to act to allow plans to brand a higher normal retirement age to help, you know, at least be in sync with Social Security's full retirement ages.
You're mentioning your profession. I have to divert things a bit to tell the old story about the difference between economists and actuaries. Economists, like actuaries, are good with numbers, but they don't have enough personality to be an actuary. Are there any comments on the branding point, which I think fits in with the emphasis on the way in which policies are framed? What you're saying is the actual policy may or may not change, but if you identify as the age at which retirement is meant to occur, or that is normal, or in some, in Deb Whitman's terms, she wants to find a complementary term for that age and a less complementary term for earlier ages, that will actually have a material effect on behavior.
Could I just respond to you? My point was simply, I mean, I'm not telling you as an actuary what discount rate you should use when you're making calculations for whatever it is you make calculations for. What I'm saying is, if you are talking about people making decisions about what they want to do and when they retire, and they think about what is the value of money that either they have or that they might have and that they might invest, they don't think it's zero. Okay, and so if you're wondering about their behavior based on their perceptions and their actions, I think you have to ask what they perceive to be their discount rate, not what you know based on a market in tips, which is dominated by institutional investors looking for places to park money, and not by individuals wondering about how they're going to pay for their retirement.
Steve, I don't disagree, but I would say the following. Our assumption of zero, the average person that you're talking about does not think about real interest rates. They think about nominal interest rates.
Well, there's that too.
And so our assumption of zero corresponds to two, nominal. I mean, we're not assuming zero nominal.
Okay.
So we're a little closer to your guys.
Okay. Fair point.
Gary.
I want to turn the discussion back to something that Steve mentioned, and it's come up over the course of today's discussion, and that is the assumption in the long run of full employment. So if there's a desire of older workers to join the workforce, then the private market is going to create the employment opportunities for them to do so.
Right.
And Steve points correctly to the fact that there's long spans of time when that's not been true. If the words Spain 2012, Greece 2012, Europe 1980 to 1995, and the United States of America 1929 to 1940 mean anything, they certainly mean that you can have long periods of time in which there is too little demand for people to work. The point I would like to make is that in the United States, there's a very strong inclination on the part of most neoclassical economists to think that that is a short-run problem, that in the long run, if people want to work, employment opportunities are going to be created for them. And I think that we haven't changed our minds. I'm putting myself in that majority. In our modeling for this project, we did not assume that there was instantaneous market clearing. We assumed that there was going to be a lot of extra unemployment, and we even made assumptions and looked at alternatives where sometimes it's spread across just the aged and sometimes it's shared with a non-aged too. But we do think that looking at the long record in the United States, that by and large, eventually policy gets things approximately right. And so this assumption over the time span that we have to think about retirement policy, which is certainly more than 10 or 11 mm-hmm. years, it's more than the span of time that Europe had excess unemployment, it can be resolved. And I just want to hear what the counter argument to that is. What evidence over long periods of time in a country like the United States has there been a shortfall in the willingness of employers to create employment opportunities for everybody, whether they're women, they're minorities, they're aged people, to create those jobs?
If you want to think, I'll let me just add.
I can't go toe to toe you with on this. I just would ask you to observe what you have observed. Over the long run in our country, and this is not Spain and Greece, and it's not Europe. We have much more flexible labor markets, and they clear, and we have wages that go down here. Unfortunately, we can see that happening for a lot of groups. But I think we tend to underestimate the pockets of structural unemployment, and that that those are real. They don't go away as quickly as we would like, or as our models say they would, and you know, for a long time, economists like here or like across the street say immigration has no effect on wages, has no effect on employment. Trade has no effect on wages, it has no effect on employment. Well, I think we now know that it does have an effect on wages, and I would argue that over even medium terms among certain people, particularly people with certain education, maybe a certain age, it can have some pretty serious effect. And so from a political standpoint, if nothing else, you want to be careful about saying we need to encourage as many old people as possible to stay in the workforce when we have, you know, when we have a lot of 20-somethings, including 20-somethings with college degrees, who are unemployed and underemployed. It's just not a fanciful problem.
Steve, I don't think you two necessarily disagree. I think what you're saying, Gary, is in the short run, you'd have higher unemployment if more elderly wanted to work. And in the long run, you'd have lower wages if more elderly wanted to work. That's the way the market clears, right?
That's what I think.
He's not saying you're going to have full employment and no depressed wages. He's just claiming that it's the wage that's going to make the long-run adjustment.
Okay, so the United States is the example where the wages are less sticky. And my son, and I don't reason everything from my own experience. My son's wage is zero. Okay, so, you know, obviously wages are affected. But and that's how we do it in this country. But even so, I would say that, you know, we all know there's some stickinesses here. And be careful about assuming things that when we make models, you have to oversimplify and you assume things. But let's not forget that we've assumed things and we're assuming away the problems that I'm trying to point out here. That's all.
Our gentleman in the back, or a lady, I can't quite see the light.
I just thought that I should mention that David Weiss has done a study.
Could you introduce yourself, please?
Excuse me? Sorry. My name is Marlene Lee. I work at the Population Reference Bureau as a demographer. And David Wise has done a study that has looked at the displacement effect of employment of older persons on youth and actually found that there was no displacement effect in this. This was a cross-national study.
And so, because that's the story behind that is?
I'm sorry. I don't remember the the story behind it, but I do remember the finding. It's been a couple of years since I've read it, and I thought you might be interested in looking it up.
Okay. I think the story has got to be that much along the lines that Gary described, which is that over the short run period, if you've got excess supply and you add the supply, you're going to make unemployment rates higher. But over the long run, and these are time periods over which even relatively rigid labor markets gradually adjust, mm-hmm. It's the capacity limitations that determine how far demand policy can go. For the bulk of the time periods during which you are at or near full employment, if you have expanded the labor supply pool, you have expanded capacity to produce and very likely actual output as well.
Okay, so let me just pose just two little wrinkles, and then Gene wants to say something. Just consider that over the next 15 years, we are going to have a macroeconomic fiscal drag. Okay, so that's one thing affecting aggregate demand. Secondly, the extra income, as I was talking to Gene before, earned by older workers, the propensity to spend the marginal dollar by those older workers is not the same as the propensity to spend the marginal dollar for sort of an average middle-aged worker. So that person is going to spend more of that money. Therefore, it's not going to be adding to the same degree to aggregate demand. So, I'm just posing all sorts of little wrinkles here to the neat little model that it's always going to come out right. But I'm not questioning, obviously a lot of women went to work and somehow we got to be a richer, a bigger economy. So that we did that. And we got a lot of immigrants and we did that too. Just saying, it isn't always so smooth and easy.
So another occasion, it roughly 1970 or so, the baby boom hit the labor market. It was delayed a little bit by the Vietnam War, particularly for men. But you could see in the short run, the economy had some problem, and wages were depressed a bit as the labor force.
Yes, $89 a week was my first.
I mean, you could kind of see the market working with the entry of the baby boomers into the labor market.
Rich, did you still want in? Rich Berghausen?
Yeah, I just want to take a look at the opposite way of thinking about it.
Okay.
In looking at the unemployment rate as a key parameter, there is a tremendous tendency to reduce the unemployment rate, not by increasing employment, but by providing an alternative way of getting those people who are not working not to be unemployed. And I just happen to be involved with the history of the Social Security system enough to know that in 1936, this was one of the major reasons why people were supporting a Social Security system so they would reduce the unemployment rate. And as a result of that, in the original rules, if you worked at all, $1, you lost all benefits. So we have to be careful of the sort of notion that we're going to use the disability program or the old age program as a way to hide our unemployment. And I think there's cost to that in the sense that eventually these people can work, should work, and working actually increases GDP.
Right. I just calling for a policy of neutrality. I'm not trying to encourage anyone to work or discourage anyone from working.
Gene Sterling.
I do have a question this time, but I do have the comment. I think a lot of people think the current system is not neutral, and they're moving towards neutrality, Steve. So there's a little difference between saying the changes or the other direction. But the question I really have is for John and Henry, and I wonder if the debate you're having isn't really the wrong debate in the context of reform, where you talk about the changes that John proposed, and actually I think I suggested Medicare as a secondary payer back 20 years ago in a book. A lot of other people have done that. It seems to me these are horizontal efficiency things. We're saying the system's inefficient. It's not providing equal justice for people who maybe have the same lifetime earnings but get very different benefits. And so we're proposing fixes on the efficiency front to promote employment. And then Henry says, but it might cost the system something. And John said, well, maybe it might not cost the system something. And if we're really doing reform, don't we just make other adjustments elsewhere? Can't we just change the rate structure, the benefit formula, or 47 other? Isn't that the real way? If we have inefficiencies and what we economists will call horizontal inequities in the system, don't we still want to fix them?
I couldn't agree with you more. I would like to point out, however, the radical political implications of John's Medicare proposal. At root, the argument is that treating health insurance cost as part of the compensation package creates distortions in the both the labor supply and the labor demand side of the equation, and he proposes basically to take it out of that calculation, but only for workers over age 65. It seems to me if the principle is valid, you want to do it for workers at all ages, and that calls for a completely different method of health insurance coverage in the United States than one based on employment. And if one wants to take the principle that John has articulated, I welcome you to the group that favors Medicare for all.
Let me just say that the idea can't be that radical because the policy I proposed was the policy for 18 years. From 1965 to 1983, we had Medicare as a primary payer.
Deb Whitman again. John, your estimate of how much people will need in retirement was huge for the coming generation, but you were just looking at a replacement rate, not at rising health care costs, and in particular, long-term care costs. The average nursing home now is $100,000 a year. So how can we incorporate that into what really people will need to have for retirement and those types of transfers that would be necessary?
Increases the...
Well, I don't know the answer to that, but it leads to the same conclusion. I think what Deb's saying is that my assumption that that the retired people only need 75% of what they had when they were earnings might not be right. They might need more than 75%, particularly the very elderly who need nursing home services and so forth. And all that does is make it even more dramatic that you can't finance those last 30 years of life with 40 years of work. We might have to go back to 20-year retirements, which is kind of what we had 50 years ago.
Are there additional questions from the back? We haven't heard from some people in the audience who I know an awful lot about this subject and have some fairly strong personal views on it. And it's late in the day, but I would love to hear from those who've remained silent. Stan Ross, who definitely fits the mold of a strong opinion and a lot of knowledge.
I was a Social Security Commissioner and the only one who actually reformed the disability program, maybe the only one who ever will. And that is a bridge to the comment I want to make. I did a paper a few years ago, looking at all these incentives in the law for early retirement, like the age 62. They were all one-off amendments for somebody on Ways and Means or Senate Finance to sort of deliver a bobble, a benefit. There was never a single policy discussion. You add them all up, as I did in this article, you do have a system that's tilted towards early retirement. And if we could get to neutral, that would be pretty good, much less get to a system that encourages more work in later retirement. It'd take a lot of legislative engineering to do that, which brings me to my agreeing with John Chauvin. I think the big problem is, can you adapt the institutions anymore? We have not seen a major reform of the tax system or the Social Security system in a long time. Ideology seems to be replacing policy analysis and evidence that leads you one way or another. I happen to agree with John. I think the real big issue going forward is whether the political system will allow us to adapt the institutions that we have, whether we'll get tax system, a social security system, that all of us would say, well, that's more suitable than what we have now. What's your judgment, John, since you've identified this as up there with, you know, extreme weather and climate change, as to whether we're going to get that turn?
Well, I mean, I think we haven't really gotten started in the sense that, you know, before you're going to have major reform, you have to have a major understanding of the problem. Kind of like, the, you know, how long did it take to lead up to the 86 tax reform? 10 or 15 years. And so, but I think if people understood that there is some commonality between the bankruptcies of several cities in California and the problems of Southern Europe, I mean, I think these ridiculous, my word, retirement ages are a common element. And once we kind of realize that, you know, retiring at 55 and you're going to live till 90 is just nuts, then we might begin to change it. So I actually probably overinterpret what I've seen play out the last 5 years. By the way, interest to me, this is real completely speculative. Isn't it interesting, though, that the sort of world economy kind of fell apart in 2008, exactly 62 years after the baby boom started? All these retirement systems were doing fine when nobody was retiring. And then, oh, my God, everything fell apart. Now, I know that's overinterpretation, but I think the you know, these pension systems and retirement system and retiree health and everything else have problems dealing with these new demographic facts.
I'd like to pick up on the issue of neutrality, which various people, Steve is four square for neutrality, and also go back to what exactly does neutrality mean? And the reason I pose the question is the first of the major studies, international comparative studies, that with which David Wise was associated in collaboration with John Gruber, was an international comparison of the core, a core element of which was calculating something called retirement force in the retirement systems. I may be oversimplifying, I may not have this exactly right, but fundamentally it was, if you work, does the retirement system tend to raise or lower the net wage that you receive for an additional year of work? You pay taxes, but you acquire some additional benefit rights, so those offset. What was the measurement in various countries? Well, in a number of European countries, the implicit tax rate was enormous. You worked, you got a wage, but your net wage when you did all these calculations was a small fraction of your stated wage. In the United States, it was almost exactly spot on. The retirement system was very, very close to neutral. So, if you're the classical neoclassical economist who believes that people perceive exactly the incentives to which they're exposed and reacts to them, we had neutrality. Now, I don't know what's happened in the years since they did their study, but I don't think anything material. If anything, it's tilted perhaps a bit more toward favoring continued work, because the retirement side of things has gotten better because of increased longevity. So the accumulation is greater. But so if you say the system isn't neutral in the United States, you have to be invoking things other than the neoclassical indicators of how the system affects people's behavior. You have to be invoking liquidity constraints. People really want to quit work, but they can't because they don't have physical access to cash until they get to be age 62. And then you see the spike that to which attention was called in the morning session.
By the way, let me just add one thing, though. Would traditional DB plans, which still exist in state
very
and local workers,
incentives.
If you work beyond the normal retirement, what they call the normal retirement
absolutely.
Age, you really
and that's
lose.
Been a big change in the United States. They've diminished yes, in coverage and right. importance, and they will diminish in right. all likelihood further. And I think most of us regard the, maybe not the loss of defined benefit, but the loss of the incentive to retire as a step forward.
Right, right.
So what I just think it's very important to be clear on what we mean by non-neutrality. Non-neutrality, I think, is sort of qualitative access, characterization of what normal behavior ought to be. But it isn't the inherent economic incentives in the retirement program. So a lot of what's being talked about, I do think, goes back to the observation that maybe we could find a way of making early retirement just uncool, unchic. There are other things along the lines, I think, that Rich has emphasized in the reforms in the structure of disability insurance. Right. That could go a long way toward helping people who really could come back to work if given the right services at the right time, if employers were motivated in the right way to help them do that, that there are really big opportunities for gain. But that isn't, in the sense that we're using the terms here, neutrality or non-neutrality. It's behaving sensibly in the face of real problems. Gary.
Well, I would go further. Hank, and I would say that the story of Social Security from the birth that Rich described, when there was one retirement age, 65, if you deferred retirement after that, there was no adjustment in your benefit. If you earned any income, any wages at 65, you were prohibited from collecting a pension. Okay, so putting us on the scale that that David Wise and John Gruber, we were at an extreme tail back then, and the fact that by the time they did their book, we were on the extreme other tail of having a relatively neutral public pension system, except, as you say, the suggestion, well, age 62 is the early claiming age. Why not stop working right now? Why not claim a pension right now? But from the point of view of neoclassical economists looking at that, it's neutral.
Okay. Well, then that's good.
If anything, as John points out, actually we give you such a big payoff from deferral that maybe we're even more generous. But it is neutral, I think, financially.
You don't think so, Jim?
Medicare,
well,
that's not true.
Well, you want to take in Medicare. I was going to get to Medicare in 1 second. Medicare makes it unneutral for a perverse reason. It is the route to an affordable group insurance rate to buy health insurance, and it actually keeps you in employment. It's the reverse, right? People have an incentive to stay employed until 65 when they finally have access to an affordable health and group health plan called Medicare.
That'll be less true in 2014.
Okay.
We hope.
You guys are talking about one, Henry, you and Gary are talking about one type of neutrality, which is roughly speaking, if you delay from 62 to 70, the Social Security benefit is roughly neutral. John's neutralities were between whether you paid this additional $5,000 Medicare tax for working versus non-working, and he was also talking about the fact that Social Security, for instance, only count, you pay the extra tax or you only count 35 years. There's a lot of other non-neutralities in the system. You're right in that the one you two are referring about is roughly neutral. The decision between whether my benefit goes up or down, whether I work another year, but there are a lot of there's also the non-neutrality between the singles and the heads of and the married. There's the not it's the non-neutrality on the Medicare, the non-neutrality on the number of years that the Social Security counts.
Why somebody wrote a book on that.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what I meant. There are a lot of new non-neutralities.
I want to say that coming to this point at the conference with a concluding comment that. If not more research is needed, certainly more reading is needed, is altogether appropriate. I want to thank you all for hanging in there and staying with us this long. And I think this subject is not going to go away.